Okay, we were just going through a bunch of these fellows that have an impact, will have an impact in this time period when we're going to deal with in the next lesson. And let me just hit the remaining three or four, real quickly. William K. Pendleton is one that was involved in part, came out of the fact that Campbell was up and writing, and his father actually got wind of some of Campbell's writings and led to the obedience of his father, and then eventually William was also converted after even hearing Alexander Campbell speak. Turns out that he was also a son-in-law of Alexander Campbell and ended up helping Alexander Campbell start Bethany College. We covered that back when we talked about Campbell. And then he became co-editor with Campbell of this Millennial Harbinger. And in 1849, when they had the meeting that would form that thing we haven't studied yet, the American Christian Missionary Society, he was actually there instead of Campbell and represented himself, but also represented Campbell in that meeting. Subsequent to that meeting, Campbell would become president of the ACMS. He took over as full-time editor, and then he took over after Campbell died. He took over Bethany College, and he was very influential, and you can kind of imagine that when you think about it. Here it is. He's a co-editor, then the editor of this paper with Campbell. He's Campbell's son-in-law. He was a teacher, and then eventually the president of Bethany College. So he had a huge influence, certainly, if not the most influential after Alexander in this time period around the Civil War. He was certainly one of them. Then McGarvey. McGarvey is, I think, the first guy we talked about that's actually a second generation Christian. His father, his parents were Christians. In fact, his father... what I was going to say about his father. His father was a Christian. His family was. He ended up then having his father died, and he ended up being his mother ended up marrying a doctor, a well-to-do doctor. McGarvey himself, with his father gone, heard very little about preaching early on. That was very instructive. In fact, it was faith. It was a faith-only kind of doctrine. He ended up going to Bethany College. He was exposed to the gospel in Bethany College and ended up being converted there and baptized the year after he arrived. He heard, of course, Campbell. In fact, the guy that baptized him was one of his instructors, Pendleton, we just talked about. He began preaching in 52, and he was a student not only of the Bible in English, but the Bible in Greek. So he had a fair amount of background in the original language. He ended up preaching. He was in Missouri preaching when the Civil War broke out. And McGarvey was one, and there were a couple of these guys that was very opposed to the Civil War, Christians going to war, period. And so he fought that for some period of time. He also had a period, or the church there, he had a run-in. The blacks there's a large number of black members, and they had a gallery they sat in. And he arranged to have them come down into the auditorium, and that didn't set well with some of the people there, so he would eventually leave. He ended up going to the College of the Bible. College of the Bible is actually part of the evolved into part of the University of Kentucky School of Bible, and then it would later, I think it was 65 or something of 1965, turned into the Lexicon Theological Seminary. Associated to this day, it's a seminary of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. That's how that evolved through time. He stayed with that school for 40 years, several of which he was president. He ended up in Lexington, of course, with the school, and was serving as an elder in the congregation, the Broadway congregation there. And until actually his deafness caused him to resign. But they, shortly after he resigned, they brought the organ into the church, and he left the church and went to another church because of that. You probably run into some of the things he's written. If you ever had a copy of the Fourfold Gospel, that's his. He was a prolific writer, probably most prolific in that period of time beyond Alexander. As mentioned, he was opposed to going to war for a variety of reasons. We won't go through those now. He did support the American Christian Missionary Society, so he was a society promoter, supporter. And I don't think he was not a strong... He did not strongly go out and try to teach on it and influence others, but his name, just the fact that he was accepted it, his name was used to encourage that continued organization. And he was strongly opposed to instrumental music and refused, as I said, to be a member of Broadway because of it. Then David Lipscomb's another guy that I think most of us probably heard that name. His father and uncles ended up, they were Primitive Baptists, and they were, again, like some others, studying the Bible and found there were some things that didn't set with Baptist doctrine, and they ended up being tried for heresy and excluded from the fellowship, and they became identified with a congregation that had been established by Stone. David himself ended up in... I tell you, these kind of things just impressed me. I wish I had this kind of capability. When he was 13, memorized all four Gospels in the book of Acts, which would be a good achievement for anybody. I don't care what age they were. He went right shortly thereafter, during that period of time, he went to stay with his grandfather and ended up trying to convince his grandfather, even though he'd never been baptized for the remission of sins, he tried to convince his grandfather at the time that he needed to be baptized. And he refused to join the parade of young people who would go to the Mourner's Branch bench while he was living there. A year later, he ended up being obeying the gospel. And then a year after that, he went into Franklin College, which Tolbert Fanning was involved with, and ended up being strongly influenced by Fanning. He came out of that, started preaching and farming in 58, and then would become the co-editor of the Gospel Advocate, and ended up being eventually the chief editor. David Lipscomb, I guess, is associated with the Gospel Advocate, you know, is the name of people that's associated with the Gospel Advocate in his formative years and for years to follow. Because of Fanning's activities, most of the editorship was handled by Lipscomb. And both of them strongly opposed the Missionary Society and used the paper to fight that, as well as the instrumental music. He founded the Nashville Bible School in 1891. This would become David Lipscomb University and is to this day. And founded that with the help of James Harding. As I mentioned, he was also opposed to the war, and he took strong stands against the missionary societies of the day and instrumental music as well. One of the things that came about during this time, or was getting solidified during these times, was the whole business of kind of sectionalizing. After the war, the Gospel Advocate actually shut down during the war, and after the Civil War, they brought it back. And he made a comment in the course of that and why it was needed. He said that there was not a single paper known to him that Southern people could read without having their feelings wounded by political insinuations and slurs. He said that had more to do with calling the advocate back into existence than all other circumstances combined. So, you know, this was a trend that was developing. The Christian Church was sort of is consolidating in the north. What would be the conservative Church of Christ was more the southern bent. And this paper, helped that, as did papers that were written by those who were disciples. And then finally, is Harding. Again, Harding was a second-generation Christian. Both his parents were members of the church. And his father was actually a preacher and an elder both. And it came a point in time when the instrument was forced into the church where he was preaching an elder, and he ended up leaving, and they split, and they formed another congregation in the area. James Harding ended up being baptized during a meeting conducted by Laird. He was only 13 years old at the time, and he would then go on to attend Bethany College, like some others we looked at, and by 74 he was preaching full time. And he was only 17 at the time when he went out to start doing that. And he, you know, some of the, he was totally into evangelistic. I said 17. Not sure what, you can do the math on his age. For 17 years he ended up preaching meetings. That's all he did for 17 years. And so he ended up having meetings, many of them would last 3 to 10 weeks at a time. I think Sunday to Sunday's bad. Try 10 weeks. And he would carry the baptismal clothes with him, change his clothes with him when he went around preaching. Of course, he would insist that people would be baptized immediately following the service, and would provide the clothes for them. He was a strong debater, over 50 debates in his lifetime. You may have heard of the Harding, at least the one I've heard about is the Harding-Nicholas debate on, I think it was on baptism, if I remember right. He started the Nashville Bible School with Lipscomb, as I mentioned a while ago, and one of the reasons they started this school was they saw a need for more preachers. So the school was started with the mission to generate preachers. And they did that for a number of years. And so he gave up being a full-time evangelist and ended up just being a teacher, became a schoolman. And then he would go on to found another college, Porter College, and it finances stopped it after a few years. So this 1850s, 1900s, you see when you look through, at least I hope you do, you see when you look through these people, or just kind of listen to their life, they end up, the main actors that were active, looked at as leaders, end up being associated with schools and papers. And they will push their positions, whatever those positions are, through those schools and through those papers. And you see that, and if you do enough reading, it'll come through very clearly what an influence they had through those.
Was that the main reason why they all started colleges?
To push their views? Well, and I don't want, when I say push their views, that's a very negative connotation. They would start the colleges because they viewed a need to train other people to preach, and that was their methodology for doing that. It wasn't to push a position.
You were mentioning some of these schools are still around. Are they conservative?
Or? There are. By and large, depends on what you know by conservative. There are a whole litany of them that are church schools of the Disciples of Christ. Nothing liberal, nothing conservative about it. In fact, that's one of the problems that we'll hopefully talk about in the 23rd lesson. higher critic, because they went into very liberal. Some of the schools went very liberal. I guess people would say Florida College is, quote, conservative. I don't know that David Lipscomb's all that conservative anymore.
They are liberal. They've
yeah.
been liberal a long
they've
time.
They've been,
I mean, Abilene is that way.
They've been associated with Gospel Advocate for a while.
Yeah, and Neil Hardman.
The thing that people have to keep in mind in these colleges is the general thrust of these colleges to go, quote, liberal. Not just in the church, you know, or church.
No, it's true of all of them.
Look at the Baptists.
Yeah.
There's a continual struggle between Baylor and the Southern Baptist Conference.
Oh, yeah.
Even though the Southern Baptist Conference sets the regents that are over Baylor, continuous struggle between them. And so that's the norm to go there.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things in there is the scripture.
There's some difference between that Baylor wants to teach and
some real. Harding start
Harding
University, or is it just named?
It must just be named after him, because didn't see any place where he started. And I didn't try to track. I mean, a lot of these schools have changed names too along the way. Lesson 22.
Well,
yes.
I have a question. When you talk about these colleges being liberal, do you mean that they're constitutional and that kind of thing, or are they going to go beyond that?
Go beyond that.
I
mean, yeah. Look, you got the thing. You got to. We're not going to talk. I'm really not going to get into this in any of this class, any of the classes we've got left. And so I'll just briefly mention it now. What would happen is you'd have a school start. It may be teaching like Lipscomb taught, following basically a very conservative. Religiously conservative line. It was a school that was supported by tuition and people contributing to it, and alumni and that kind of thing. And what would happen over time is a couple of different things. One, the school would want to grow and grow, and the way they would do that is they went out and eventually they'd start soliciting money and for expansions, and then they'd start soliciting money for the churches. In fact, one of the statements is that you had churches that many churches were amenable to that because they'd been through the missionary society argument, and they were in favor of the missionary society kind of organization, and they saw this as a good work. So you get a stream moving off in that direction. You get a stream that has to do with the higher criticism, by what they call higher criticism biblical interpretation, and so it ends up being very liberal, even to the point, I think Jim made a comment, even to the point, eventually you get to the point where the scriptures are not inspired. And certainly, before they got there, creation is theistic. I mean, creation is theistic evolution kind of thing. So those sorts of things. There is no one line that you can follow on this. There's a whole...
There's really no difference between them and even a school like Baylor or anything else.
Oh, no. Not at all. Some of them. Well, look. Disciples of Christ, Christian Church, Disciples of Christ will not... They would not get upset if you call them a denomination. That's exactly what they call themselves.
Okay.
And we may get to some of that.
In the early days, some of the stalwart... preachers who stood for truth in debates and standing when the liberal, you know, movement came in, attended some of these colleges, you know, and had their teaching and their background.
Sure.
And, you know, at these. And so it wasn't that they learned era, you know, at there. It's just that, you know, it crept in after. And they went here, but they stood firm for truth.
Yeah. Some didn't go there and stood firm for truth.
In the early 50s, we set money to have a Christian here.
Did you really? Okay. All right. Lesson 22.
Mark of the Beast.
Okay. The authority. I just wanted to, you know, briefly review. Just really, we don't have time to do anything but fly through this. We've had studies on authority. Well, Lord willing, if we live long enough, we'll have more studies on authority because it's so important. Just in simple terms, what is authority? Define authority for me.
It's right.
Okay. It's right to act. It's true. What else is it right to do?
Rule.
Right to rule. Who has the right to rule? Well, that's a dumb question. Genesis 1, I'll say it a different way. Genesis 1, Romans 1 teaches what about God? I ought to ask the question. Yeah, God has inherent authority. God is because he is the creator. And all other authority, all other right to govern is, and it really is a right to act, is delegated. Matthew 21, 23, 27. What did you learn from that?
Man or God.
And so if we're talking about it in the religious sphere, and we want to know what God would have us to do, we have one place to go, and that's his word. There are only two alternatives that, let me rephrase that. There are two alternatives in terms of authority. You can either, and I'm going level beyond man or God, you can end up, or stating another way, you can either end up doing what the scriptures specifically or generically authorize, or you take the position of what is not strictly forbidden is okay. Those are kind of two positions you can take. And how in the world do you interpret what Jesus said in Matthew 20? And y'all, let me go back to Matthew 20 here and key in on the words. 28:20. Excuse me. Thank you. He says, "Teaching them to observe all that I commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even at the end of the age." And you've heard this, I mean, Steve's preached on this point. Who's Jesus talking to? He's talking to Jews. How are Jews going to understand that? They're not going to understand it to mean, well, anything that's not specifically forbidden we can do at all. When you go back and look at Deuteronomy in particular, 4 and 2, there's one place you can look at, 5:32-33 is another place. Hey, we're going to get to that in just a second. So you see that you don't add to nor take away. If you want to know what you're going to do with God commanded, there are the two limits. As Mike says, Hebrews 7, what's Hebrews 7 tell us? Hebrews 7, 12 through 14, to be specific. What do you learn from that?
About
the
change of priesthood, you know, the necessity to change the law.
Okay, Jesus from where? Jesus is from the tribe of?
Jesus.
And what did the law say? Tribe of?
Levi.
The law said the priest had to come to the tribe of Levi. And so you have a, you got to change the law. The Bible was silent relative to Judah. Speaks nothing. And so, the fact is, silence does not give consent. This is a fundamental issue that we've been talking about throughout the, particularly the Restoration Movement. Silence does not give consent, and yet that's what a lot of these early digressions are built around, is getting your consent out of silence. Okay?
Some of the great debates, through the years have made that point very simple. Like I said, when you send your child to the store to get a loaf of bread, you don't tell them not to get ice cream, not to get candy,
yeah,
not to, because it never ends.
Right. And the fact that it's absence, the absence of not to or absence of to, doesn't give them the right to go out and get ice cream either. So silence doesn't cut it. Okay. When you look at the Restoration Movement, I listed three things here for you. And I believe this. If it was nothing else, The Restoration Movement was an attempt on the part of those people to go back to the Bible and use the Bible as their sole authority. And they made those, you know, even with these differences, they would still argue that point. The old Last Will and Testament of the Springfield Presbytery, which was involved with Stone, you know, one of the things they willed that our power of making laws for the government of the church and executing them by delegated authority forever cease. The people have free course of the Bible. Campbell's Declaration and Address, the divine word is our standard. When they dissolved the Mahoning Association, there was a resolution entered at the time that the Mahoning Association as an advisory council or an ecclesiastical tribunal should cease to exist. And we'll revisit this in a moment, but Campbell was actually opposed to the motion. You can kind of understand that as you watch history go by. There are two alternatives, and what would happen, growth would bring about these opposing attitudes. And there are two alternative attitudes that develop. One being that the New Testament reveals this fixed pattern to be followed in terms of the church and the life of the disciples. And you know, really, this was exemplified, I think, in the rule, depending on how you interpret it, which I think somebody pointed out the first time we brought it up, is where the scriptures speak, we speak, and where the scriptures are silent, we are silent. So one view is there is a pattern, and that's to be followed. The other view is adapt. You adapt to the culture in which you find yourself. And all you have to do is look at, you can look at history and see that, but there are leaders that would make that statement, that they need to do that today. There are some other factors that I just want to bring to your attention. And if you ever have a chance, anybody ever seen or ever read The Emergence of the Church of Christ Denomination? Yeah, it's an excellent, simple book, excellent book. By Ed Harrell, who wrote it as an objective historian. And I just called some of this out of his studies. And he really said, look, you can look at the history, and there are some factors, sociological factors, that get involved. And we've hit on some of these as we've talked through the classes in the past. One is sectional, and you would see when you look at it that there were sectional splits. In our country, it was obvious that with the Civil War, that was bringing about a division, an impact on this Stone-Campbell unity. And it would separate in part because of the slavery question, but also because of urban versus rural had an impact. And these things, needless to say, these things are intertwined. None of them are just standalone on their own without any other interaction. Second one was economical. When people became more affluent, they became more tolerant. Their zeal dropped. They were more involved in the things of the world. And that was not so much, it was not a, you know, everybody in one section is rich and everybody in one section is poor, but it did tend to be the northern tier of states ended up being the wealthier, more affluent area. And so again, that sort of reinforced this sectionalizing. And then the third one was psychological, having to do with sophistication of people, being world, having better education, being exposed to other thoughts, worldly thoughts, world learning, refinement, and so they began to be exposed to those things and became first of all more tolerant of them, and then after that they just start adopting them, and so you see that you can be shown over and over again just looking back on history, and those of you who've read the book. We'll see that. And there's another book, by the way, called Attitudes and Consequences by Homer Haley. He goes in a lot, his book's like so. He goes in a lot more, has a lot more data around that if you're interested. Attitudes and Consequences. And it really is dealing with his fundamental attitude, difference in attitude around the scriptures. But he, you know, he tracks the evolving, restoration movement on up through, I think his goes up to like 1940s or something.
But when you look at Ed Harrell, he may have got called up to Unity University later on.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't have data. I mean, I'm not.
He got called up to the former head of teachings on marriage, divorce, and remarriage, but he never run the sports anymore.
Well, you're gonna run into. I've already made one spiel on this about how I think we get there's no question people are influenced by their associations in a way around that, and to the extent that we've seen it in history, and it's just a question of will it impact those who are members of the large church. This whole business about the influence of schools on preachers. We're not going to go there. I'm going to leave that alone. Don't ask me a question. This is outside of class. Yeah, it's men. And we'd be just as influenced individually.
Like I said, that book that Harold wrote, that's a good book.
Yeah.
But whether he went on off to, La La Land after that, this
Historical development. Let's talk about these. Let's talk about how do we get to these missionary societies. If you go back and look at how this all came about, it really started with these so-called cooperation meetings. They really were the seed of really thought and action eventually around societies, missionary societies. And early on, O. Scott had written for Stone's paper and favored these cooperation meetings, not for legislative purposes. Really, they were people to get together for mutual encouragement, to find out what was going on in the other churches, supply those churches couldn't have their own local preacher with preachers. So they wanted to cooperate. Let me leave it at that. There's really a fine line between that and something greater than that. Campbell himself, when they dissolved the Mahoning Association, it's kind of sad, I guess. It's just, what are we, brethren, what are you going to do now? You no longer have this association, was Campbell's view. And he could not see how the gospel could go forward efficiently, effectively, without some kind of association, and he would eventually get his way. So he, at the Mahoning meeting, suggested they have a meeting or association shutdown. He suggested they have a annual cooperation meeting, which they did. Started off their first meeting, I mentioned in your notes. And the real question there, if there was no association, how could the world be converted? I will make an observation that I'll reinforce one I made before. What starts to happen, and we've already seen looking at these people, is instead of preachers going out and being involved in either in local works or in tent meetings or going around on circuit preaching, but being out and preaching, what happened is they moved into the papers, largely. Papers became the vehicle of teaching. And we've hit them. There's a whole litany of them. I got probably 15 papers that all popped up about this same time. And they're papers by the guys we've been talking about all throughout here. And then there's some other people that were involved as well. So these papers became the teaching vehicle. And with time, when you get into the late 1800s, early 1900s, the papers took on lives of their own. They took on a personality, if you like. Of course, to a large extent, it was the personality of the person writing the paper. But you had people that followed the paper, churches that followed the papers. You would eventually develop into where some of the papers, at least the editors of some of the papers, would end up, it got to be a very personal thing between editors and opposing views. So that's just a fact. You can look at it and see it. Looking at Campbell himself, looking at the evolution of this, it's interesting that Campbell, very first time he wrote the Christian Baptist, and I think I may have given you parts of this quote before, he was very much against any kind of organized society. And you can look at the quote I've given you, the last part of it, the last sentence: "They dare not transfer to a missionary society or Bible society or educational society a sin or a prayer, lest in doing so they should rob the church of its glory and exalt the inventions of men of the wisdom of God." Later, O. Pendleton would say, well, what he was really talking about was not societies, but really the abuse of societies. But I don't think, you know, objective, you can't read what he wrote and not come away with a conclusion that Alexander Campbell in 1823 was opposed to any kind of society, missionary society, Bible society, any of that. But he did favor these cooperation meetings, where in his view you form an organization that would meet, where you could have this kind of encouragement of one another, and the kinds of things I've described earlier. In fact, he made a statement: "I have no objection to congregations meeting in hundreds at stated times to sing God's praises and to unite their prayers and exhortations for the social good. However, when a forum is called for the business of the churches, they are a popish calf, a muley, or a homeless stag, or something akin to the grand beast of seven heads and ten horns." So he had an opinion about that kind of a group at that point in time. But within 10 years, he's writing articles in his paper that is promoting cooperation. And he fundamentally believed the world could not be converted without churches cooperating in evangelizing. And that's what his articles were pleading for. And he said, you know, he'd argue that the churches in the New Testament cooperated, but the how was left up to churches to figure out on their own.
That's a lot of what this Baxter says here when he shows, you know, the radio program and the television program, the orphan songs and all that. You know, he's just building on what he's
sure.
How good that work is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you see, there's a sentence here in his quote I made: "The New Testament furnishes the principles which call forth our energy, but suggest no plan. There is no pattern. There is no plan," according to him.
Well,
yeah.
Was there any watershed event that swayed his opinion on it?
Not that I've seen. Not at all.
He just gradually made the transition.
Yeah, seems that way. Or he may have had it in the back. Well, I don't. I mean, you can't get away. I just can't get away from 1823, and I don't know of any event that changed his mind per se. But you can take a look at that. We'll go on. He wrote these articles, ended up being influencing, strongly influencing, as you might imagine, others. And you started to see these cooperation meetings happen. One of them that happened was early on, 1834. Worth noting to see how people interpreted what was being said. It was a church in Wellsburg, Virginia. 13 churches represented there agreed to employ 2 evangelists, appoint a treasurer to receive funds from the churches for the evangelist support, and set up a committee of 13 to supervise the 2 evangelists and their work. And they disbanded that cooperation after about a year. They figured out that wasn't the right thing to do, or they were having trouble anyway. You did have statewide meetings that came into being with time, and as early as the 1840, you see statewide meetings in half a dozen states being advertised in Campbell's papers. You did have people, and I named one here, Henley, that viewed these with some misgivings, But what they did, instead of tacking it on the basis that there was no authority for it, they thought there was a better way. And they favored the cooperation, but they had some other thoughts about it, and so they thought you ought to come through a local church. And what would happen as a result of that is you actually had churches sending to a church when that church had a preacher they couldn't support to send out, and they wanted to send out, they needed more funds, so other churches would support that. Whether or not they ended up having more than one preacher that they did that with, I don't know, but that got to be a attractive thing for people to do. Sponsoring church. I mean, this is the beginning of the sponsoring church arrangement, which was very hot and heavy later. It really didn't come to the forefront that way, but that's exactly what it was. Campbell himself didn't believe the cooperation meetings had gone far enough, so he started writing again in 41-43 and ended up proposing the establishment of a general organization that would provide for some body of act. And he argued the church is described as the body of Christ, therefore a body necessarily must have organization. Now, I'll grant the premise for a minute. The body of Christ needs to have organization. What is the organization of the body of Christ? Well, wait a minute. Yeah, you're ahead. Yeah, the body, what he has in mind, actually, it is Christ is the head, and we are the followers. And that's it. There's the organization. So he did have an organization, didn't he, another one? And he also would admit that the New Testament did not provide for any general organization of the church. But he concluded, as a result, therefore, that you had to create such a...
He saw no organization in the Bible.
I'm sure he would say local there were. Remember, Campbell views the universal church as made up of churches.
Okay.
All right, we will pick up there. I can't talk fast enough, I'm sure, to get through this lesson or lesson 23. Try as I may. So y'all, go on and look at lesson 23. I don't know why. I have to decide when I'm just going to try to hit high points, kind of skip around, so at least we cover some of the material.